This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about change as a factor in our mental health. And I really do mean our as in us the hosts, because this episode, it is just the two of us catching up on a lot of changes in our own lives, including some very exciting things to share. And yeah, we're looking forward to just having an in-depth catch-up, which with the rush of covering all our different themes and having new guests every week, we often don't feel we get the chance to really get into it.
Because we have so many great conversations, don't we, off air all the time and before we get in the day, and we have amazing catch-ups and we do digress and we love it though. I feel like our digressions are full of interesting stuff. So yeah, it's great for you and I just to get the chance to share some of that to the listeners.
Yeah, because that's what the listeners don't know. There's usually like at least an hour or two of us like chatting off mic every Monday when we record and just catching up on the world. And it's always deep stuff. It's like, oh, what TV have you been watching? And from there it goes into like talking about trans rights or talking about politics or family or whatever else. So great chats. And yeah, I always look forward to our Mondays. And like I said, we're going to talk about some changes coming up. Obviously, where we're at in terms of the pandemic, I think for both of us feels quite pivotal, that I think we're feeling a lot more like Freedom Day is kind of now, as opposed to when was, you know, so-called Freedom Day. Like, it does feel like things are more normal, as opposed to that day where we went from, what was it, a Sunday of the restrictions to then the next Monday we're meant to feel safe. I've had my second jab now, so I think we're getting there.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, this Monday, there were new restrictions lifted, weren't there? So now if you get a ping or you find out somebody in the class is in the kids' class isn't, has, you know, been with somebody that's had a positive test result and has COVID, we don't have to isolate now. So I think you can quote me on that, but yeah, you don't have to isolate now if you get the news. They do, but you don't.
I think maybe the caveat for that, as far as I remember, is if you've been double jabbed.
Or you're under 18.
Yeah, so that's exciting. So yeah, got the double jab. It's interesting, the whole vaccine passport thing, isn't it? Because it does seem, if nothing else, it does definitely seem to be happening for nightclubs. And I do think that's probably a bit of a push for the young people to be like, you are less at risk of this, but here is another reason why you should get it. And the vaccine passports, as much as people would want to in government deny it, they are in place for travel as well. You know, other countries are using them. And in Ireland, they're very much used. So, you know, going out for a meal, going to certain sporting events, there are loads of day-to-day situations where you need a negative test or to be double jabbed. And actually, there hasn't been a huge backlash there. There's been a backlash to certain things that haven't made sense. Like they opened pubs for takeaway at one point, which was very strange. So you could go and get a pint in a plastic cup and you had to leave the area of the pub. So you can imagine there's just hordes of people drinking in the street. And then the guards are worried about like, well, this doesn't feel any safer than if they were all sat outside the pub. So, you know, not without flaws. But yeah, it's interesting just how even at this stage, when we know so much about the virus, we still have to take it with a pinch of salt when, you know, the government say, oh, we're not going to do this, or we're definitely doing this.
Yeah, definitely. We were laughing, me and my friends of the day, because as I've said on the podcast many times, I think I have spent my life going out. Like if I was 25 during this lockdown, I would have really struggled, because my whole of my 20s and probably my 30s was spent going out. I've been a going out girl. And obviously now that's slowing down a little bit. I mean, it's not in terms of going out. Maybe where I go has changed, but I'm still always up for a Friday night and a Saturday night, getting old, getting my heels on and seeing the girls. Like that's just the vibe. But I'm not maybe in like some of the big clubs anymore. But we were laughing the other day because we were like, well, hold on, like we're old now. It's the passport thing felt like ID. Like, well, I don't need, like surely I'm going to rock up to the door. And I'm like, it's obvious that I've had two jabs. I was like in the first group of vaccines. No, I wasn't in the first group. But, you know, me and my girls rock up, we, you know, come on, we've had a jab. So yeah, we're just having a bit of a laugh about it. But I think it makes sense. Like, at least it's just following on, if nothing, from, as you said, some kind of instruction that they've tried to implement certain rules about what we're going to do. The whole thing really hasn't made sense for the last few months, you know, with all the sporting events and all that. You know, I've got 7-year-old class not being able to go in, but we've got people at Wembley. Like, those things have been quite an issue for me and a lot of parent friends, because it's been quite hard managing school and stuff. But, you know, they're trying. And what's been amazing is the vaccine rollout. So many people now, you've had your second jab, and I think most people in the population will have. And we'll see how, you know, this passport thing or the restrictions still may have an impact. I'm sure that will be the next thing that we start to hear in the next few months, you know.
And I think in some ways it's maybe been easier for us because we are very happy to go along with the restrictions. You know, we can be critical of it, but at the same time, like, I don't really want to go to a nightclub unless I'm double jabbed. So, you know, the passport thing isn't going to be something that, for me, I feel like is a hindrance. In the same way, like, if I was to go to Dublin or if I was to go to much of Europe now, if you've got your double jab, you come straight in. Whereas if you don't, you have to usually get a negative test and you have to pay for yourself. And it's all, you know, I don't know how they justify the cost of it, but somebody's clearly profiting. Or you've got to quarantine. But then I'm someone that's double jabbed and happily double jabbed. So again, it doesn't feel like a hindrance. So, yeah, we're getting to a point where it does feel like we're maybe as free as we wanted to be anyway. And that's quite nice. And talking of freedom to travel to places, I've got an announcement that I've been keeping very quiet, to the point where it's quite strange, right? Because the dates have changed a lot about this, and I didn't want it to affect whether or not I was getting work projects and stuff like that. So I've had to keep quite quiet. But I am moving to Dublin for 6 months as of next month, so September.
Yay!
Yeah, so it's very much something I'd wanted to do for a while, you know, have a bit of a time away. I'm not somebody that really takes holidays. I work really flat out, and being self-employed, I would have to either have the work wait for me or still do a certain proportion of it when I'm away. Or I have to find ways to delegate it, which is often more work. And so, yeah, I've been planning this for a while, and very much in lockdown when I realised I wasn't going to be able to move in 2020 like I'd wanted to. There's nothing like being trapped at home in a city that you love, but it being empty and everything being shut to make you restless for a move. And so I'm very ready for it. And part of the reason we're having this conversation today is I did the first part of my move on Monday. So move the stuff that's staying in this country to my parents' place, and then the rest will be coming with me.
I can't believe how organised you are. Your boxes, everything's just, you're just I can't believe it, actually. You're not a disorganised, but I can believe it. But maybe I'm just comparing it to my moves and how they feel. But it's so exciting.
To be fair, the movers were surprised as well.
Were they?
Yeah, and they were like, you're really handy with packing up these boxes. And I was like, oh, I work in logistics. That's why.
I think you may stay for longer than 6 months, mate.
Well, let's not call anything now. My parents are very keen for me to stay. As you know, they would, my mum in particular, because she is from Dublin, wants to kind of de-emigrate via me. And I'll be staying in what was my grandparents, so parents, her parents' side. I'm staying in their flat. So, you know, it feels like a kind of full circle moment in a way, working really hard the last few years and not being to visit Ireland as much as I would like, to now like have the chance. And hopefully it's good timing as well, because I think people's lives are still ramping up. So hopefully, at least for some of the 6 months, there's not going to be as many projects I'm expected to do here, and I can have my time.
You can. And also what's brilliant is, I think, as we know, we're talking about change, and the fact that you're moving at a time when there's so many change, especially when we're thinking about cities and new jobs and students coming in and out. And, you know, when I say students, I I always think of students of all ages. You know, I was doing my degree, first one at 27. Like, there's people of all ages and movements and people from all backgrounds around this time, this kind of autumn change. So I think you go in when there'll be loads of singletons, loads of people out there just looking for new friends and new relationships, and there'll be loads of newness. And so you'll be like throwing yourself into a time when there will be probably quite a few people out there that are like you, that are just looking to like connect with new people and, you know, seek new opportunities. And just, you know, I think that'll be it's a really cool time to do it.
Are you foreshadowing our other podcast there, the dating one?
Yeah, no. No, I'm not actually even thinking about it from a dating point of view, just as a people to people point of view. I think it's a really good time.
Yeah, I hope so. And obviously the question I get next from everyone is, well, what are you doing there? Not as in why there? People understand why Dublin, but what will I actually fill my time with? And a lot of it will be spending time with family, particularly my mum's side, all over the world, but the bulk of them are in Dublin. And obviously my dad's side, a lot of them are in Donegal, so I've spent time with them. I've got family in Cork. And so, yeah, a lot of spending time back among my culture more. And also, I will continue this work. If anything, the pandemic, hopefully that's, you remember at the start, we were talking about our potential positives. Hopefully that is one of them, that we've had a lot of practice of Zoom recording. Although there will, I would imagine, be an increase on Irish guests that I get to interview a person as well. So there'll be a whole range of different accents on the pod. My accent will probably come back a bit as well.
You already have a slight Irish twang going on, and I'm hoping, yeah, you'll come back and we'll hear it even more, that beautiful accent.
I have that weird thing where I say the phrases, or I... like, you notice, like, my elongated vowels, like we were doing the Grass & Co. ads, and you were saying, oh, you say it so well. I say grass, and you say grass. Yeah. And I don't think I'd really realise that, because I'm so used to, like, obviously there's a whole north-south thing here with, you know, do you say grass or do you say grass? And I obviously say something that's like a neither, a long version of one of them. So, yeah. I guess grand is the main one that I say a lot and people notice.
Yeah.
But there's other phrases and stuff. So yeah, that I'm a little bit daunted about, as silly as it might sound, because my voice has never been so much of my work as it is now. So there is part of me that's like self-conscious about that. But I, you know, I'm not going to sound that different.
No, of course you won't.
I'm just going to have more of a twang.
Yeah. That'd be cool.
And yeah, so I'm looking forward to spending time with family, continuing the projects I'm working on. I'm going to probably try and get involved in work there as well, whether that's charity or, you know, some side hustles, whether I work on new podcasts. I've got potentially a few in the pipeline of podcasts I might be able to produce, which we should have updates on in the coming months. So yeah, a lot of changes. And it is very strange to think, this time next month, I will be living in a different city and indeed a different country.
Absolutely. And actually, speaking about the city, is the apartment in the city or not?
So I think people would describe it as Monkstown, where I'll be, but I think technically Sea Point. So people tend to go by like the bigger area and say that's where they are. I guess people will recognise it easier, but specifically I'm in Sea Point. So I'm right by the coast and I'm on the Dart line. So basically the Dart is, I guess, Dublin's equivalent of the underground. Like, it's not underground, but, you know, it's kind of this tram train type setup. And then it's about a 20 minute journey along the coast into the city centre.
My goodness, why did I even ask that? I'm just feeling more and more jealous as you're talking about it. Imagine that, though, being on the coast in 20 minutes and you're in a city. Like,
well, you're going to come visit.
Yeah, of course I am. It's like Barcelona. Like, I love that about Barcelona, the city sea thing. I just think it's like such a cool vibe. So you'll wake up and you just be there on the coast. How nice will that be?
I know. I know, it's surreal, really. And obviously, from spending so much of my childhood there, I know the area really well, and I know that flat, and I, you know, feel very familiar with the city. There's definitely going to be an element of things have moved, or the local corner shop isn't there anymore, and that's annoying. But
yeah,
it's going to be very cool to be back. And it's actually a commute I'm excited about.
I was going to say that we're talking about it being like 20 minutes. And if you live in London, that's really not much. I guess if you live here, if you live in Birmingham, it's not much. But you are used to being right in the middle of the city. So, you know, you come out your place now and you're just like 5 minutes away from every shop and food place and coffee shop. And you enjoy that time out when you go and walk, and you just walk around the city and people stimulate you, and you kind of love that. But what's nice is, you know, even being by the coast, I guess it's obviously it's different, but it's something as stimulating. You know, it's still an environment that will bring so much to you. So it might not be the city that you're used to stepping out and seeing, but, you know, to be there by the sea and the coast, talk about like mental health benefits and all those kind of things. I think that's, you know, in the environment, the clean air. No.
My mum's a big one for breathing in the sea air.
Yeah.
Like, it's a prescription. Just go and walk by the sea, and that'll sort you out. Yeah, I am excited for it. And I think I'm looking forward to that change of pace a little bit. You know, like, I'll still be working, but I'll have the environment around me be a little bit more chill. And there's a definite difference in kind of demographic as well. Like in Birmingham city centre, it's very young, it's very fast paced. Monkstown, it's a bit older. You know, it's people that are more settled, it's a lot more people that are retired. You know, people don't tend to retire and move into Birmingham city centre. They tend to move out to somewhere like Monkstown or equivalent. Right. So yeah, I'm excited. So that's the big update from me. And we're going to talk a little bit in the episode about why I guess I'm so excited about the change in pace and sort of breakthroughs and realizations I've had. I know there's changes you've got to talk about in terms of back to school and all the dauntingness of that. And you're going to be interviewing me for this one. The tables are turning.
Yeah.
So with that all said, we will resume the conversation and talk about some big changes that are going on, I guess, for us mentally, if that makes sense, as well as physical changes, like the very obvious move, in a moment. But first,
who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
So hi, Bob. We're here today together. And would you like to start by, I guess, introducing yourself as our guests would regularly on the show?
Sure. So I'm Bobby Temps, and an early experience that's relevant to share today is talking about very early childhood. And this is something that I don't talk about that much. Like, I've talked about it on the show, the listeners are aware, but I don't tend to go into depth. And that's because this still is really clear ways in which this impacts me today, but I think very relevant to what we're going to talk about. And that is like the level of fear and survivalist mentality I had when I was really little. And I don't really know when this started. You know, I think like the why am I thinking ballroom? What is the ball ground? What do people say when it's an approximation? Ballpark, there we go. So the kiddie pen figure for this young kid, I just remember how aware I was that there wasn't a place for me in the world. And I know that sounds very dramatic, but what I mean by that is from a young age, I was aware that I didn't know where I fit. Like, I felt very different. I felt like I didn't belong. And to a certain extent, as I got older, I found that to be true. You know, all those typical kid experiences, like people ask you what you want to be when you grow up, and I would give them a list of things, and apparently that's wrong. You've got to choose one thing. So I can say astronaut, and that'd be very, very unlikely, but I can't say more than one job. And obviously, fast forward to now, I have several jobs. But, you know, there was just all those moments and, you know, times when what I now know is depression was really affecting me, where I was really unhappy and I didn't know why. and I couldn't explain it in a way that adults understood, or because of stigma, sometimes it was ways that adults didn't like when I did try and explain it. You know, that was a real strong awareness of me, that I didn't fit in and I didn't feel normal. And seemingly the only way to navigate that was to make space for myself. And I was little, so I don't, do you know what I mean? I can articulate this now.
Yeah.
I knew what a lot of it was, but at the time it just was fear. It was pure like dread, like the adrenaline, but the scary version, mixed up with the depression, which again, I don't know how early that started, but I would imagine very early. It was very much like day to day, get through it, wake up, another day. This is horrible. I'm waking up with this dread straight away. And how do I get through another day of this? And, you know, all the things we talk about, like masking behaviors, were very much there, because, you know, people don't want you to be sad as a kid unless you have an explanation for it. And even if you are, they want to be able to fix it quickly. And that was not my experience. And so, you know, there were a lot of times now which were sad memories for me, which should have been happy memories, like birthdays or like family holidays, things that felt very stressful at the time, but we would usually imagine as good things. And I think part of the stress was how much I was hiding it and how much I was putting on a front. And, you know, now I tell people usually quite early on when I meet them that I have issues with my memory, because there is a lot of stuff that I just don't know. And as an adult, I can correlate that. I can correlate that to times that were really dark and I don't remember that much of them, you know, and I know now that that is a part of depression. But, you know, that just added to the feeling of being broken, that there were just whole things in my life that I couldn't remember, like this whole like family holidays. I've no idea I've even been to that country, or I go somewhere new with a friend. When did this last happen? I think this last happened when I went to Chester and I realized I'd been there before and I had no idea. And that was, I mean, this was later, that was when I was in an abusive relationship. And that was like a day trip we went on and it's completely gone. I recognized it when I revisited Chester, but I had no idea I'd been there before. And so it's strange even now to look back and think like how much I was in that survival mentality. But that's the best way I can describe it, really, is I just thought there's no place for me and I'm just going to have to fight and stand up for myself and somehow pull together some, because that's also the thing, I had no confidence. I really hated myself. I hated the sight of myself in the mirror. I hated who I was. I hated that my life wasn't easier and I couldn't just be happy like other people. Obviously, we know, were all of the people around me actually happy, or were they also engaging in masking behavior? But at the time, it was incredibly isolating. And I often describe that with depression of when I didn't know what it was, I just thought it was loneliness. I just thought I'm a lonely, damaged person and something went wrong and I'm ugly and I don't know how I got such a shit hand of cards in this life. Mm-hmm. And I either give in to that darkness that leads wherever it leads, or I fight for myself and for my confidence and make something of my life. And very much was brought up in a household where you work really hard and you make something of your life, and if you have to move country to do that, that's part of the Irish experience. And it's, yeah, something, like I said, I don't usually talk about to that depth, because it's, I don't know, am I describing this well?
Yeah, well, I mean, thank you so much for sharing that though, because that's like some deep shit, you know, and to be able to describe feelings of being so small, you know, and so young and having some kind of recollection of a feeling, you know, a dark feeling at such a young age is hard. And to be able to come through that. And when I hear you say, you know, you said quite early on that I needed to carve out a space for myself. Like, how old were you about that time? And where did that come from? Because there are a lot of people who will have experienced what you experienced when you were young, who didn't see that as an option, who still don't see that as an option and who fall down something much worse than that. You know, there's some strength in that. And I'm just wondering where, how old you were and maybe what encouraged you or motivated you to recognize that that was something that you may have to do. And now we know how amazing that is. And we would want everybody to be in that space of, you know, uniqueness and feel that being completely different from everybody else and not feeling like you fit in is what I would hope my children would grow to be like and be strong and powerful about that, you know, but it's not, society doesn't always let us have that. So yeah, where did that come from?
Honestly, that's a really difficult question. I guess the only answer I can really give is there was obviously something in me that I wanted to survive. And this is why it's difficult to describe, because so much of my memory is really blurry of my childhood in general. It's difficult to explain, right, when you don't have something. Like, I can't really explain how little memory I have of my childhood. You just kind of have to take my word for it. And obviously, you know, getting to know me, there is just a lot of information that I just don't have. There are questions I can't answer. You know, when people say, like, what was your first holiday? Where was your favorite place to visit? I don't feel I can answer that because I don't remember everything. And, you know, when was your first kiss? Don't know. Like, things that are, you know, massive deals in people's lives, and particularly anything where there would have been stress related to it, a lot of that is gone. Equally, I don't know what I thought, and this is something I've been dwelling on a little bit recently in counseling. I don't know what I thought the alternative was. I just knew that that was scarier. Like, there were definitely times when I didn't know if I could get through each day, and the dread would kind of overtake me, and I had to have other people kind of help pull me out of that. And, you know, and sometimes I joke about being a very good candidate for counseling because I do a lot of my best thinking out loud. To a degree, some people are like that. They're very able to find a lot of the answers within themselves as opposed to externally. And I think I'm very that way. And a lot of this is kind of shaped by experiences. If you look at the world and you're like, I don't belong here, then maybe you have to find something. And, you know, then me setting up businesses and podcasts and creating all these jobs for myself, it makes more sense perhaps in that way. So I don't really know what I thought the alternative was. I don't think I would have understood what suicide was. Like, I was aware of it, but it was a very kind of vague, abstract concept. I think maybe all I understood was like an idea of crashing and burning. That if I got off this treadmill of survival, then I don't know how bad things will get.
Yeah, but you didn't seem to, this is the thing, that off that treadmill, you talk about carving a life that does look maybe different to what society or your family may have expected. You could have gone down a very conventional route and gone to college and university and got a job 9 to 5 and lived, you know. That would have also been an alternative, but you still managed to find, or and still are maybe navigating and carving out your journey. And did you get much or any support with that as you were growing up? Were there people that you could lean on and reach out to? Because you mentioned counselling, you know, how early did you find that maybe leaning into support or receiving support was helpful?
I think I did get a lot of informal support. You know, I got a lot of love at home. I got on really well with like teachers at school as I grew up. I've always had really great friends. There was one point around kind of 15 or so where I lost a lot of friends, and that was a very dark time. But broadly speaking, you know, yeah, I did always have people I could talk to. They weren't always necessarily parents or adults that you would imagine, but there was always people, even if it was exclusively my peers. And yeah, so I think I was able to kind of talk through a lot of stuff, but equally I didn't have the knowledge. You know, I didn't know that I was dealing with two mental illnesses and, you know, things like having dyslexia, you know, very severely made schooling very challenging. It's sort of a weird thing to answer, right? Because you said about, I could have had a different life. I could have gone down a more conventional route that was expected of me. But I don't know how I knew this, but I think I knew that I would be more unhappy. Like I was already very unhappy, and somehow I knew I would be more so. And then very much when I got into schooling, then a lot of that seemed to be confirmed because, you know, my parents have gone down a very academic route. My mum works in a university. You know, they're both involved in academia very much today. And with the dyslexia, you know, I was struggling to read. Like I couldn't read with any proficiency until secondary school. So when I like got to GCSEs and I got grades that I was like, oh, I didn't know I'd get these grades. There was a contrast with what was expected to what I was like, oh, I'm pleasantly surprised. And so, you know, that continued of me having this kind of confirmation through education, through sort of career talks, through whatever else was happening of like, yeah, there isn't an answer. The answer still is fight, you know, and like that's the mentality. And as an adult, which is part of what I wanted to talk to you about today in terms of breakthroughs, I've had to tone all of that down. You know, I at school, because I get it now even where people meet me and we chat about life and school and stuff, and people are genuinely very surprised that I wasn't bullied. People will say that to me, which is a weird thing to say.
I don't know whether that's a compliment or not, is it?
I think they're genuinely looking for a reason. They're like, explain yourself. Even if they weren't a bully, they're like, well, I can see what they would have chosen. You're different in a lot of ways. And, you know, I was a pretty emotional kid. I wore a lot of my heart on my sleeve and I was very kind of turbulent with a lot of my behaviour looking back on it. Things would affect me very deeply. And, you know, I'm still pretty like that. I'm just better at managing it and I'm better at not hating myself for it. That's, I think, the biggest difference, because there was a time when something would upset me and it would ruin my whole week. And it would also ruin my whole week because I despise myself for that reaction and want to pull all the emotions back in and push them down and, you know, mask up. And yet, you know, you can't do that. Like, I don't think it's successful. You know, we've talked about things all the time on the podcast with the guests where there was kind of leaking behaviors, I would describe it as, you know, that there can be symptoms that come out. You know, sometimes when people are anxious, they, you know, they pick at their nails or they tap on the desk or they tap their foot while sitting. You know, there's ways in which our mental health can sort of seep out in ways that we don't maybe realize, even if we're suppressing it, or at least we think we're suppressing it. And so I think for me, that kind of fight mentality of survive, battle through each day, you know, very, I guess, stereotypically male in a lot of ways, right? It was very like that. And I think people could tell. I think people could see it behind the eyes. I didn't really get into many fights as a kid, but I definitely was ready to fight, particularly through like secondary education. Like I was scrappy. I just, it didn't come to that generally.
Yeah, was that, and as you said, maybe that's that survival instinct that, or mentality that, although when you hear you talk on one hand about your struggles and things that you're experiencing internally and mentally from a very young age, it didn't seem to, yeah, it was masked. It didn't seem to manifest itself in, you mentioned bullying. And when I think back to my childhood and being at school and the kids that I knew were getting bullied, they were on their own, that didn't have a voice, even though they probably did and probably do now as adults have more strength than the people that were bullying them. And the bullies would have probably dealing with a lot more that was being masked. So, yeah, it's interesting when you talk about that. And, you know, people are surprised that I wasn't bullied. And when they say that, do you think that's generally because they know you now? Or are they surprised when they think, when they hear you weren't bullied because of knowing what your history was like and what you went through?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you get to know me initially, there are things that, you know, a bully might choose. And to be fair, people tried. It just didn't really get anywhere for them. Yeah, and I think it was that thing. I was just always had my guard up. And I think the toughness was something you could tell, even if I was like clearly very sensitive and someone that in many ways you would target, there was also an edge to me. And, you know, I was very good socially. You know, I always had a lot of people around me and stuff like that. So other than, you know, that part, which I wrote about, actually, if anyone's looking for a book, Hope Virgo's second book, I have a section in that, like I wrote a sort of mini chapter for her. And in that, I talk about that time, actually. And it wasn't really until writing that that I connected how much like that was a real point of like the eating disorder strengthening, like really embedding, like the symptoms, the issues were clearly there from younger, but going from being popular, being pretty autonomous within school, you know, having different options and where you sit in the cafeteria, that kind of stuff, to then having this kind of fallout with quite a few people, and then suddenly feeling very socially isolated in a way that I already felt kind of emotionally isolated in many ways. You know, I went from that, being around people, having a good support network, you know, being like, oh, who do I sit with today? To then sitting in the library and skipping lunch because I didn't know where I belonged in school anymore. It was that much of a contrast. And so wow. The behaviours around food that I was already maladaptive on, wow. That's when they really became a routine of like, okay, well, I don't have lunch anymore. This is really part of my thing. And, you know, obviously my parents didn't know about that. And that went unchecked. You know, it wasn't a school where they had like a, you know, they weren't ticking off who hadn't had lunch. So that was very easy for me to fall into that pattern. And, you know, things got better. You know, I made new friends and I moved school for A-level.
But the eating disorder stayed throughout that. When you say things got better, so
socially,
Yeah. But just to be clear on that, yeah, so things got better socially, you made new friends, but that those behaviours around food remained.
Yeah. And my school I did my A-levels at was more regimented about food. You know, you would very much go with your year group to eat, and it's a very different environment. Without getting too much into it, it's the kind of place that you would have managed to miss like maybe two lunches and then everyone would be talking about it. So it was just one of those places. There wasn't a huge amount of that kind of privacy. Everyone was very in each other's business. So I guess that kind of maybe kept me stable to an extent, but you know, I wasn't eating much. I was just eating at the times when I was meant to. I think dinner was the one I could skip. In fact, I take this back. I think I wasn't having dinner. It's weird, but again, it's like the memory stuff. A lot of this is just sort of either gone or it's behind like semi-transparent glass.
And then what happened? And then what? When we left college, and then I know you obviously went to university for a short time, realized, why am I trying to do this? Get me out of here.
People can listen back to the university episode, actually, if they want a deep dive on that. I should have never gone to university. It was, there's a backstory on why I ended up there, which you can hear on, we did a like two-parter on education, and I think it was with Jenny. Anyway, I'll put a link in the episode description. I'll find that later. So I'm a university dropout. That was a real low point for my mental health where it got really bad. And I think as an adult, that's the worst I've been. But that's also when I got my depression diagnosis. And then a little while after, my anorexia diagnosis. And, you know, that one is still, like, I accept them and I feel very empowered by the diagnoses and they've helped me make sense of a lot. But the anorexia, here's something vulnerable. If the listeners look out for it, you'll notice I rarely say that word. I more commonly say eating disorder. There's still a part of me that struggles to own that. And I think part of that, unfortunately, does come from the stigma. And like I've talked about many times, me growing up not knowing, simply not having seen ever that men are affected by that, or, you know, seen it represented. I'm sure I met people. And there's still a part of me, if I'm really honest, that feels guilt for that.
Mm.
Because it can be characterized so much as something you do to yourself. I know that logically, what you are doing in terms of the behaviors is a symptom of what's happening mentally for you. in the same way me not being able to get out of bed some days because of depression isn't me keeping myself in bed so much as it's a symptom of the inner turmoil.
Yeah.
But there's still some work I have to do around eating and around knowing, you know, I know logically, I get it. I get how it relates to control. I notice times when I'm worse and times when I'm better. And broadly these days, I'm very stable. But there's still stuff. There's always stuff.
And to be honest, Bob, we all would say that anybody that experiences mental illness, they are all extremes. We all know that there's a logic that we may, if we've tuned into it, be quite aware of. But the logic means shit when times are hard. Like we know a logic, you know, there's some of the behaviors around that. We can sit back at that and look and reflect on that tomorrow and think, what the hell was I doing? But at the time, don't tell me not to do that behavior, please, because that's what I'm needing to do to cope in this moment with whatever that is. So, you know, we talk about the logic and the struggles there. And like you said, there's always something, but as we know, and we talk about on our show all the time, like we feel the strength. And you said that earlier on, you know, it's given us the power. If only more of us could be supported through therapy and it was easier to come by with before we get to kind of rock bottom, you know, before the shit really hits the fan. I'm obviously always, you know, pushing for that. It's one of the biggest things that I feel so strongly about, that we wait and wait and wait, no fault of our own or even people around us. Maybe it's just the way that stigma is about mental health and the environment that we live in. But you know, we say we didn't even know anything was wrong. I didn't really know. I just couldn't describe the feelings. It's just things were just really shit and really dark. Maybe in those moments, if we had some intervention, things would be different. But we're dealing with it now and young enough and got so much life and to live and to be around us. It's just amazing. And I wonder at what point then realize that, you know what, I need to go and talk to somebody professionally. There's a corner now that I need to turn, and I think I need to get some help, because I know that you love the support that you receive from your counselor, and I know that you get so much out of it, and there's insights that you want to share about what you've learned, especially in this last few years or last year, especially in the last few months, yeah. Maybe. But when did that start then? How did that journey come about?
Well, you've reminded me of a phrase I sometimes use, which is carried fear. And I think that's how I would describe what certainly for me came from very young. You know, so that fear of like, if I go too into these feelings, I don't know where that will go. I guess, realistically, I don't know if I can survive the level of pain that I'm fighting to either deal with or dodge. And I think that is a common experience living with mental illness, because you do have that buildup. You've got these feelings that you're not connecting with, and whether that's, you know, survival in the moment, whether that's, you know, very situational, if you've had something happen to you, which we would associate with PTSD, for example, you know, there can be this very strong mechanism internally where we just push it down. We might forget it. We might fear it. Whatever it is, there can, I think, be this quite universal build-up, even if the individual experiences are different. And then it's almost like sometimes you get to a point where you know you need help, but you're so in the trenches with it that the idea of taking on board this stuff that you're trying to push down or trying to sort of survive with and just carry on your back, it feels like too much to bear. And so, yeah, I think I very much had that. And so it took being at uni, knowing that I didn't want to be there, again, feeling like I don't belong here. Like it's strange to describe, because obviously uni is such a brilliant experience for loads of people. And I'm always kind of conscious of that I fully have so much respect for people that have gone and got degrees, because I was not capable of it. And maybe people will hear that and they'll think, no, Bobs, you do so much, you are capable. I am not someone that excels in that environment. I just about got through A-levels and I was counting down the days to being out of learning. Mm. I love learning through talking to guests. I love learning through the research and the stats. But that kind of structured learning that also, not for nothing, is so memory orientated.
Yeah.
And so often written, which again, the dyslexia is coming up against, it's not my kind of way of being able to show intelligence successfully. And so being in a place I didn't want to be, I didn't think I should be, and I didn't think I would belong. And, you know, I'd given up jobs and stuff to go to uni. And, you know, I remember from day one, I remember from being dropped off by my parents and thinking, what the fuck am I doing here? And I went and walked around in circles of Bangor in Wales. It was so different to Birmingham, so different to Dublin, so different to what I knew a city to be like. Mm. And I just literally went round in circles, walking around, trying to take it in. I think I spoke to a friend on the phone. And I was just like, I don't know why I'm here. What am I doing? And, you know, that feeling only got worse. And so that's where, to answer your question, that's where like the depression diagnosis came initially. And shortly after, I got out. And the first time I got counselling was through a workplace, not long after I was working in HSBC. And that was like a free employee benefit that you could have sessions of counselling. And, you know, I clearly at that point knew enough. You know, yeah. I sold it to people as like, oh, well, it's free, I might as well. But, you know, obviously internally I knew that there was stuff I needed to deal with and I was still very much in my conditions. And that was really good. And it was a set number of sessions. It was over the phone. So it was really easy to set up. And I think I had weekly sessions and found a lot from it. And then we got to the end of the sessions. So I left that having explored counselling in a way that was quite seamless, that it was free, that it was set up quickly, that I emailed an external company. You know, my boss didn't have to sign off on it or anything. It was just a star in terms of how to do that within an organization. Obviously, someone in HR knew and would have signed it off, but, you know, just added it to the bill with all the other people. And so that was a really great introduction. And so from there, then I looked at private counseling because I knew I needed long term and the chances of getting that on the NHS. You know, I mentioned Hope Virgo earlier. She's got a whole campaign, as we know, about taking the weight restrictions out of eating disorder support, because currently a lot of people have to get worse before they are even eligible, which is so fucked up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was aware of things like this, you know, because on the outside, I seemed to be doing okay. But obviously, there was a lot I needed to work on. And so that's why, yeah, I ended up going the private route. And luckily, you know, that's something that I've mostly been able to afford. There have been times when I've gone to every other week and, you know, gone back to weekly and stuff like that. I'm currently every other week, but that's more so there's not been as much happening in the pandemic. But, you know, that's the nice thing about private. I went to the counselling directory. I looked at who was available in my area. Obviously, I've talked about in other episodes, you know, the method of choosing, you know, who I chose. And I've been going for, I think, at least 3 years now.
Yeah.
And makes such a difference, among other things. I always feel bad saying this because, you know, this is a question I get asked a lot on other people's podcasts. They're like, oh, how has the podcast helped your mental health? And I have to be like, oh, that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, we're all about the cause here. But, you know, I would be lying if I said it hadn't had a positive impact. You know, there is something about being in the routine of talking about this stuff every week. It really is transformational. And I hear that from listeners as well. You know, that hearing these conversations, it means, you know, then when a conversation comes up, you do have more to say than you might have even thought. Because even if you're listening to this and not having the conversations as much, you're soaking up all the content. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that the way I interview my guests is very specific, right? That it's very much about connecting with them, reflecting on what they've said, asking follow-up questions, you know, showing appropriate emotional connection. And I do, you know, get really, really invested in, you know, understanding people. And I think that luckily comes across. And I think there's, you know, that's something that I had anyway from like Samaritans and Nightline and other charity work I've done. but, you know, it's been really strengthened through doing this. And the other thing, which I guess that links to something I talked about earlier of being very scrappy, I've had to learn as an adult how to soften myself a lot, to the point where people get surprised. People have to kind of get to know me to see the edge now. Still there. And there's still, you know, there's still a lot of anger, I think, in me from certain things I've been through. I think the only time it comes out is like when like cars don't indicate and they like swish round a corner and nearly hit me as a pedestrian. I'll shout at a vehicle. Do you know what I mean? Like, so there's certain little things like that where it's like, no, like the anger is like so ready. Like it takes 1 second of someone not indicating and I will happily shout at a car in front of everyone. So, like, look, I'm not advocating for that. I'm just saying that it's sometimes something that happens. But yeah, I've really learned how to like soften how I come across. And that's been, I guess, when we talk about breakthroughs and changes, that's been massive recently. I had a real stressful time recently of just, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, it's perhaps what could have been a breakdown if I didn't have all the support in place. I was staying with a friend in London. We'd gone to see a show together and we got talking about a lot. He's been going through some stuff with his mental health, and we were talking about that, and I was sharing some of the things we've talked about today because he was talking about his childhood. And it was a very emotive chat, and I was so relieved that he's doing good because I'd been quite worried about him. So there was the emotional release of that, and then there was me talking about my stuff and connecting with similarities in some of our mental health history. And I think it just really got me. There were a few things that I'd phrased that I'd never realized. Like the thing about people knowing that I'm ready to fight. I don't think I'd really said that out loud before, you know, of how true that was when I was at school. Because at the time, I think particularly as a man, you can fool yourself into thinking that's strength. But actually that was coming from pain. Like I was so embedded in my survival mode that I felt a constant threat. That's why I was ready to fight. I wasn't ready to fight because I was, you know, big, tough man.
Mm.
You know, I wasn't ready to fight because I'm a trained boxer. I was ready to fight because I thought I needed to be 24/7. And certain things like saying that out loud and talking about other things that I'd not quite phrased with the level of awareness I have now really got to me. And so I was there in the middle of the night, stayed over at his. He went quite early to bed. And so part of this was I don't go to bed that early. And so I'm wide awake, feeling a bit like, oh, can I not just drift off? And then all this stuff is spiraling in my head. I'm feeling really stressed and really lonely. And I think it would have been a lot better if I could have just gone and like had a hug from somebody. Like, you know, it sort of closed the circle of like, we have this emotive chat and then I get to sort of like be like, okay, and now we're done. And now we're good and we're safe. But something in me was just spiraling, and all these thoughts and a few other experiences had happened recently that I was reflecting on. And I think just being overwhelmed a little bit by like being out in the world again, like this mate that I'd not seen in 2 years. And now we've just gone to the theatre together and had a lovely meal. Like it's quite, following all the lockdowns, it's quite overwhelming to be so social. And obviously the listeners know now, I've got to go see a lot of people before I go to Dublin. So it does feel like a pressurised form of socialising at the moment. And it just was a lot. And so I went to, I was just tossing and turning. He's asleep. I can't be like, hug me. I have a request for a hug, which normally would actually be quite normal behaviour for me with close friends like him. And I went to his bathroom to have a cry. And I don't tend to get tearful that often, but I very much feel the feelings. Often I wish I could cry more than I do.
Right.
So when I was at that point, I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the bathroom and have a cry rather than try and shove this down. Like this will be the quicker route out of it, I think. But also I am sort of sat there almost having this like out of body experience of like, what is going on? You've had a lovely evening. Things are objectively going pretty well for you. Why are we panicking? And so in the morning, I text my counsellor and I said, can I have a an extra session this week. So I had a Tuesday session in addition to my Wednesday session, and I just talked it through. And a lot of, I think, what I'd got spiraling about was thinking that I was doing badly and that I was not coping as well as I thought I was, and that my coping mechanisms were more toxic than they are.
Right.
And so I think I needed that. I think I needed that spiral to an extent in order to push me to have the conversation with her. And it was really reassuring because she was able to sort of break it down with me and question, is this stuff true? So certain things like, you know, the stuff around survival mentality, how much am I still in that? And it turns out less than I thought. And I very much have experience of a rescue complex. Of at times it has felt a lot easier to try and save people that I relate to than it has to go near my own issues. You know, part of me was like, is this why I'm so emotional? Because I'm trying to rescue this friend. And, you know, she was, you know, wasn't direct about it, but was sort of questioning whether that was true. Mm-hmm. And then another thing was like worrying about codependency. You know, we did that wonderful episode with Tanisha and I really connected with her. And I wondered if I really connected with the theme. And, you know, again, talking to my counsellor, she was saying, well, generally, if people are really struggling with codependency as much as you think you are, that is every relationship. Every relationship is unbalanced. Every relationship, they are giving a whole lot and still feeling like they don't deserve to be there. And I do have incredibly supportive friends. And I do get so much from my friendships and other people in my life. And so I guess the way I could sum this up is I was having a conversation with Larry Dean, who is going to be the first guest of season 2 of Dating Games. And we had a conversation after our episode off air. And I think it's a really wonderful episode, by the way. So look out for that on the first Friday of September. Our other podcast, Dating Games, will be back. But we talked about off air going to counselling and how there comes a point where you have to let go of the coping mechanisms that don't help anymore. You know, they may have always been bad for you, but there were times when it was part of the survival. And something about the conversations in counselling, the things I've talked about with friends recently, and then this final bit talking to him, and feeling like I think we have quite similar outlooks, me and him, which helps. And yeah, that's where I feel now. That so much of my life has been characterized by survive, work super hard, don't take breaks, expect the most from your body, you know, just go flat out all the time. And then one day you'll belong and you'll be enough. And that's, you know, why we say you are enough at the end of the show. You know, that's as much a message to me as anyone else. And I think finally I'm at that place. And that's so weird because I don't quite know what to do with that, right? I know it feels like it sounds dramatic. Survival has been such a big part of who I am, getting through it. And I don't quite know how to not do that. But I know now that I don't need to anymore. I don't need to feel like ready to fight all the time. I don't need to constantly be waiting for some kind of attack or to plunge into my feelings and never come out. I am objectively successful. There are people in my life close to me who do not understand the success I have. I also need to give up waiting for that and just accept that I have done a lot of work. And I've just think coming out of the pandemic, it's all kind of come together and I've realized like, oh, maybe it's time. You know, it's the logic versus emotion. Logically, I don't consider myself to be a fucked up and broken person anymore. But I think emotionally, I'm just getting there. I've just kind of passed that lip. Of I disbelieve it more than I believe it, finally.
My goodness. That is so powerful. And how do you feel about that?
Honestly, free. And I think the timing has worked out for a reason. And so it is the right time for me to shed this stuff. Not that I wanted it, but you know, to an extent, it got me through. And now going off to Dublin, feeling free in a way I've not felt before, also feels correct.
And exciting. And a bit nerve-wracking. And all of the amazing emotions that we're privileged enough to even feel. I think sometimes, you know, we feel all these, this amalgamation of emotion. And like you said, we don't even know sometimes how to. It's all like kind of identifying an emotion and like being able to describe it. And then if we're lucky enough to express it is one thing. And then turning a corner, as you've just talked about so powerfully and beautifully, about feeling that stuff doesn't, I don't need to carry it anymore. I can like unpack that backpack, unpack it, and it's light now. Yeah, and there'll be new things that you might fill it up with over the years as life takes us on our different journeys. But for now, that one that's maybe been carried from a young age can start to be unpacked. And as you said, it almost feels like, do things happen for a reason? I mean, I believe they do, but you know, you could have been in Dublin 18 months ago when this backpack was still half full or however much full it was. But things have kind of happened and gone through a lot.
Is that what we're saying? Sorry, guys, the lockdowns were for me. I needed more time.
Yeah, absolutely. But maybe, Bob, because you couldn't feel like you're in a more better place to go.
Yeah, no, I agree. I feel so ready now, and that this is the next stage. And I think I needed to shift some of this. It's always weird admitting to certain things because I'm aware of how much content people can listen to and analyze out there of us on the internet. But I think that's something that did come through in the first series of Dating Games. I talked, particularly in the early episodes, about my Irishness a lot. I think it's been challenging in relationships in a way that I didn't realize. So like, there's definitely cultural differences in terms of my outlook and my behavior and how I was raised that can be challenging in friendships and in work. I think even more so in relationships. And I think I just never really looked at it. And it kind of took having a show like that, talking about relationships every week, for me to listen back and be like, there's clearly something here.
Yeah.
And I think I needed to get a lot of this stuff figured out perhaps before I went and kind of re-immerse myself in my culture and sort of figured out what I suspect will be even more cultural differences than I was aware of having to people in this country. And so, yeah, it feels like it is the right time. And again, it comes back to that like idea of having more autonomy than we think. I am noticing that coming out of the pandemic. I am noticing the difference between how people have changed. And I don't mean learning a new language, because how many of us really did that? You know, we're starting to learn languages now.
Yeah,
we're very late in the game.
We are, yeah, but better late than never. We're on it.
Yeah, but I think the big thing has been like what people are dealing with emotionally. You know, and so it's really exciting to see how many people are moving house, how many people are ready to move job in, you know, in a time where the housing market is like crazy right now, the job market, it, depending on your industry, will be wildly different on whether there's loads of jobs or not many. But I think people are coming out and they're being reacquainted with their freedom because they've been so denied it. And actually, a lot of these things they maybe could have done before, but it sort of took, you know, like we've not talked about it recently, but I'll paraphrase. There's a story that Lisa Nichols tells, who's a writer and motivational speaker who I'm obsessed with. She talked about this idea of like how people can be sitting on a nail and it can be uncomfortable enough to complain about it, but not uncomfortable enough to move. And in the analogy, it's a dog that every day is sat on a porch whining because he's sitting on a nail and he keeps sitting in the same place and he complains, but he doesn't find somewhere else to sit. And I think in the past, I found that quite tricky to be around when other people are like that, because I don't think in a lot of situations I've had a nail that was bearable in terms of like my mental health and stuff. I've had to do things to, you know, get through the days. And it's very inspiring to see that I think a lot of people are coming out of this. This is the potential positive we never even saw coming, right? That people would come out of it and they're like, okay, I've been trapped for so long. Now is the time I need to do all of the things. And that is so exciting.
Yeah, you're right. Like, we've got more autonomy. No, in fact, Dan, we haven't got more autonomy. Autonomy has always been there.
We've been reminded.
We have. It's like we've been given permission. It's like the pandemic has given us position.
Oh yeah, you're nobody if you're not moving house right now. Move house, move job, you've got to move something.
Getting divorced, something's got to, yeah. Where are you if you're not changing? Come on, everybody, make it. But as small as those changes might be, as big as those changes might be, because to be honest, there's been change for everybody, whether or not they've been proactive enough to make it. So it's actually, it's funny that we've all changed and had change, regardless of whether you're that person who says, I hate change, I can't deal with change, or that person who needs change all the time to survive.
Yeah, and change is stressful as hell, but are most life changes as stressful as the pandemic has been? I'm not sure if they are, for me anyway.
Absolutely. And change is stressful as hell for some people, an absolute coping strategy and the best thing in the world for others. You know, again, it's all autonomy, how you see the world, what your experiences are, your perspective. You know, I need change. I've always had change. I don't know anything else but change. So I, in the past, have struggled around people who have said, I just hate change. I've never changed. I've lived in the same house, been to the same school, had the same friends all my life, don't know anything different. I've always looked at them and thought, oh my God, when I was younger, you know, before, you know, the non-judgmental Danielle kicked in about 15 years ago in my days of, what do you mean? How, that's really boring. Like, why would you live like that? When, well, that's my experience, Dan. You only know change. So maybe you see that as something different. Or, in fact, there's been times when I've, you know, guests been envious of people who can go back to their parents' house and it be the house that they grew up in and the childhood bedroom that they've known, and feeling that comfort and that level of security. I 100% see now, as an adult and as a mother, that there's probably something in that too, you know. But yeah. The autonomy is the point here. I think that's a big lesson, that we've got choice.
Yeah, and to be fair, part of this is that we have needed change, I think, you know, because there's been times when things have been really, really tough and we've needed the change to feel better, you know, to feel like, okay, maybe I'm still broke or I'm still dealing with mental health issues or whatever else is tough in my life. But at least I'm training in a new job. Like, at least there's something which feels like progress, even if it's just doing a lot of sideward steps. I guess that's maybe a bit of the freedom thing. Otherwise, you can feel really trapped. And I think I can't cope with that. I think some people can have a life where they can feel comfortable in stability. I have not found the stability I've historically had to feel safe or stable. I think I'm finally getting to that point now where I'm like, okay, I can do my 6 months in Dublin. Even if I do the same thing every day, I think I'll feel a hell of a lot more comfortable in that than I ever would have done.
Yeah, that's interesting. And is that because when you said that, sorry, just to clarify, when you're saying you feel, is that because actually, after all, the stability that you may have thought you were longing for isn't all it's cracked up to be, and that you found a peace in that not being a key factor? Is that what you were saying then, or were you saying the opposite to that?
I think I'd not found anywhere that I actually felt happy. Like, I've had good days in a lot of places, and I've had, you know, so like for all the conversation we're having, so many good things have happened in my life. But there's always been that kind of restfulness. And I think that comes from a lot of like mental illness that I was dealing with. And I think with this, what certainly does feel like a breakthrough lately, now I think I can actually take a bit more of a step back and, you know, be less relentless and kind of take it down from 110% a little bit and actually feel like I'm safe to stand still or stiller.
Yeah, I love that.
Because I think that's what we want. Do you know what I mean? We want stability. Like, even if you want a job where you are someone that works from home and, you know, Airbnbs around the world to different homes, you know, that kind of like modern internet nomad lifestyle, you still want stability in it. Even if that's just having a great suitcase that's come with you for every part of the journey, we look for familiarity. And I think perhaps sometimes when you didn't feel that in the first place growing up, then it takes a while longer to find out what that is for you.
That's the point, Bobby. That's absolutely the point. Not it takes a while longer to become stable, but it takes a while longer to find out what stability means for you. And I think that is a key point, because it means something different when we're moving into another episode now, aren't we, on stability? But it means something, because with all the change that we've had, actually where we found the most stability, if we've been lucky enough to, is it within ourselves. It's the only thing we've had. It's the only control. It's the only autonomy. It's the only thing we've had to be autonomous with. And that's what we're going through internally. That's the only stability any of us have had for the last 18 months. So if that's not a fly in the flag for what we actually mean when we talk about stability, and it being nothing but something within us that sits within us, regardless of what's going on the outside, then nothing is. It's an absolute key factor in these conversations. I think that's what the pandemic has done, thrown up a whole load of shit and all the labels that we put on ourselves and the things that we think we want and that we can't survive without and we struggle without and we're not safe without. We are, because all of that's within us. So wherever you go to in the world, Dublin, or whatever happens in your life with your marriage, your children, your mental health, there's something within us. There is a resilience within us as humans. And it's there. We just don't always see it, but it's there. I feel like there will be a lot of people listening to this who either have experienced change because of the pandemic. We've just said everybody has, but maybe hasn't proactively activated change that they've wanted to, or they're worried or a little bit anxious about what this new world looks like, you know, post-pandemic and September coming back and with children at school and work and all the activities, and feeling a little bit like we can go back to what we had before the pandemic, which for a lot of people was quite stressful, hard work, non-stop, relentless, parenting especially. But I think the learning from it and the messages that even with all of that turbulence, that there's something within us that's in our minds, and not to forget what we've been through for this last 18 months and how it shaped us and how we might have moved and shaped our perspectives and the strength that we've had to draw from. That won't go, even though we're going back to maybe in some cases what we had before, that will always remain. And that's one of the biggest positives, I think, that can come out of the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So take that with you to Dublin. Take that with you to Dublin and your empty backpack and have the time of your life.
I will. And yeah, it'll be, I think, a new era for us. You know, we'll keep up the show, but I'll have a different recording location. My outlook's changing a bit more. And so, yeah, we'll see what that brings.
Will we be allowed to say, you know, you're going to let us have a little conversations in every intro? Because we're going to speak off air, but I'm going to want, and the listeners are going to want to hear every now and again, maybe one a month, where we can ask, you know, how's it going? I think we need a couple of updates every now and again on the old Dublin lifestyle.
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exciting. All right. No, we can do that. And then the final thing, very much a change coming up to you, which a lot of people are going through, and that is back to school, or I guess for some people, back to uni.
I just wanted to go, oh, when you said it, and I stopped myself because I thought, no, Dan, you're in a mode of motivation and you've got a bit of your work head on. And actually, I either go, oh, shit, or I go, wow, amazing. You know what I mean? Healthy children who are excited to go back to their education that we're so privileged to have. I can't even talk about Kabul at the moment and Afghanistan, but I've felt so privileged this week, that as a woman, as a mother, as a human being, this freedom that I have. So there's part of me that's building up, but I know I've got the strength. I know I have to get them to 4 different activities a day and get different uniforms and kits and lunches and all the things made whilst working, whilst doing all the house stuff. Oh, and also trying to have a bit of a life myself. I've got the strength and the capability to do it. So I need to remember that, as hard as it will be, and there'll be listeners out there that will be agreeing, because we've all probably just dealing with a bit of a, oh, anxiety, oh, shit, here we go. But on the other side of it, what privilege we have, a lot of us, to enter into this world of free education and hopefully health for lots of young people, and togetherness and family and freedom. And that, this week, it's filling me with strength, Bob, this week. By October half term, there might be a different story. When I'm like, Bobby, send for me to come to Dublin, please. but yeah, so much change, Bob, but I'm privileged to be able to experience it. That's my vibe this week.
Good. I love that for you. And I think a lot of people are having that. You know, I think there is an optimism that I'm finding, that there's definitely a fear, you know, and a lot of people have different levels of how safe they now feel. I certainly feel very lucky that I'm going to another country that has vaccinated so many people. But we're not out of this. The fear is understandable, but the hope is also understandable. And I hate the phrase new normal.
Do you?
I really do. I think it's just, it's so overused. You remember what was the one that, like, in the beginning, unprecedented times? And then you think, like, we've been doing this for a year. How is it still unprecedented? You know, we're like coming onto our third lockdown. It's like, no, we know what this is like. Please get the restrictions right. But maybe new era. I've used that phrase earlier. Maybe we talk about coming into a new era. And I think that means different things for different people. For us, you know, not for everyone, it'll mean moving country. But for us, it means what it means. And we will get there. We will get there. We will find things to be hopeful about. And actually, genuinely, the world coming out of lockdown is less scary, at least, like you rightly say, in this country at least, than I feared. As much as we were there with our potential positives, and we always like to, you know, find things to be hopeful about, I didn't think there would be as many people moving house. I didn't think there'd be as many people able to move job. You know, I didn't see a lot of that coming. So it's really great to just see that people that, you know, would have been very glad for the time away from a job they disliked, there is a different job available for more people than I thought there would be. So it's very exciting. It's very exciting to be pleasantly surprised, and I will take it. I am very happy to be wrong. So yeah, new era for us, new era for the show. We'll be back next week with a regular episode, and yeah, we'll keep at it. We're planning some big things on the way. Got some exciting guests coming up. We've dropped a little bit on the Apple podcast charts. So if you've ever been meaning to leave us a review, now might be the time. And at the end of September, we find out if we've won another podcast award. So thank you, everyone, for listening, as always. We hope you found some insight to this conversation, and we hope you're doing good.
Wait, first and foremost, thank you, Bobby, for sharing. And I really enjoyed asking you a few questions. I mean, obviously, you're the easiest guest in the world, because you were just talk and you just
talk.
Yeah, so I had like 3 questions, which was
you
great.
Did well. Good questions. I like them. They really got me.
Yeah, but it's nice for us to share. But you know, it's hard as well, isn't it? Because we know things about each other, and you know, and you mentioned it in the recording, didn't you? That, you know, you want to talk because we are open and we're both up for being open. We've learned that that helps, for one. And this show is about other people. So we want people to hopefully take something from it. But then there's this the little thing, isn't there, that stops you, because we are live across the internet and there's hundreds of hours of content and things you can't ever take back. And, you know, so that's a challenge. And for podcasters in general, or broadcasters in general, it's not easy. So speaking about things that mean so much to us, or that we're still living with and struggling with and experiencing, and our past, is something that I think we should be, you know, pretty proud of. So, yeah, thank you for being so open and sharing with me and for the listeners about things that perhaps you haven't spoke openly about on air before, and some you may have. And yeah, good luck. I'm going to even say all the best for Dublin. We're not yet there yet. We're nowhere near there yet. But yeah, it's great to hear the insights and, you know, the new things and that you're learning and sharing that with everyone. So thank you.
No, you're welcome. Well, it's, you know, it's honest. That's how messy mental health is, right? Particularly delving into mental illness. At the base level, these are conditions that influence the way we think and the outlook that we have on the world. And so you are kind of up against it sometimes, you know, in terms of being cohesive and making sense of your history, because your history is through the lens of how you're doing today and how you were doing at those points. And so it is tricky. And so, you know, I talk about some of this stuff quite a bit and some of it not. And as time goes on, I find different ways of looking at it. And so every time I talk about it, hopefully I get to be more honest, because I understand my own truthful experiences better. And I think that's something that, yeah, we can find power in. You know, speak up, even if you don't know what's going on for you fully. Speak about the stuff you do know and keep coming back to it. And then before long, you'll be able to fully monologue for an hour. Is that the goal? Is that what we're aiming for?
Yeah, that's the goal. No, you're right about that, because speaking about it as well provides that, the different experiences that different people have, and that maybe then aren't sure that that's valid, or, you know, because somebody else experienced something differently. And you spoke about what you went through when you were so young, but how it manifested itself, or how you managed to navigate around it. Even for me to learn about my growing up with mental illness in my family a lot, and severely, and then me dealing with my own stuff and attachment issues and codependency and all that kind of stuff, but always having a really successful, I was thinking about this the other day, whatever that word means, school and social life, you know? I mean, but isn't it interesting? I left school with two GCSEs because I left, not because, maybe this is part of it, but I left cities in year 10 and had a real bad time in year 11 and went and gone on and kind of tried to rectify that. Think I have done to a certain extent. But how interesting, I've just caught myself saying I had a really successful school life and social life at school. And then I heard my other part of my brain going, isn't that interesting? Because you left school with two GCSEs, and I'm not sure other people would say you had a really successful school life. But, you know, how interesting is that, again, perspective? So, yeah, so my point was that you mentioned about people hearing and learning and sharing and trying to be honest. And I think what comes with that honesty is, yeah, people learning about how different we all experience things and manifest things, even if we've had similar experiences or trauma or whatever, we may all manifest it in different ways. And it's knowing your truth and finding your experiences, I guess, and understanding how they might impact your life positively or negatively, and getting through them yourself for your story. That's powerful.
For sure. And the only thing I would add to that, really, and then I am done, then we will finish.
Yeah, then we're
is, done. Is that if this show has taught me anything, the thing it has taught me most is that I am surprisingly relatable. I do not even now consider myself to be a relatable person, but the messages we receive tell a different story, and I believe our listeners. And I think that's something that all of us could take on. You know, so often we can feel like we're alone with certain things, and that we aren't coping as well as other people, or everyone's happy but us. And as much as it can feel like that, it's not true. It really isn't true. I am somehow relatable, and I can't explain it, but I've been told enough times. And, you know, what it comes down to is something that Kat says actually all the time, which is whatever is personal is universal. And that means that the more personal you go, the more universal it becomes. So me talking about dark times I've had and being very open about that, there will be elements that people can relate to. They can relate to more of the feelings than they can the situation.
Yeah.
And I think in that, we can find that the parts of us we shut away and feel least inclined to talk about. And of course, like so many things in our show, it comes back to the stigma partly. Those are the very things that can really connect us. And, you know, if you want an example of that, ask people how their sleep has been in the pandemic, because I'm yet to find anyone that's had good sleep.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these things that we just often don't talk about, or we only talk to about close friends, or I don't know what it is about sleep. Do you notice the same thing? People like sort of, they don't want to admit how badly they're sleeping.
Yeah, it's true, actually. I'm not sleeping well. And then it gets pushed off. We don't really go into it, do we? Until because I've had struggles with my sleep. And it was only when I said to my friend, no, literally, I'm not sleeping more than 3 hours. She was like, what do you mean? You've been saying for ages you're not sleeping. I was like, no, I know. This is what I'm saying to you. I don't go to bed till late. We're both late people, me. I can't be in bed at 11 o'clock. So I go to bed late and I'm awake so early. And when I'm awake, and without going down and digressing again, but my whole mind is just going crazy. But I said to her, you're not listening to me. I'm not sleeping. Shit. You know, I had to come out like it's a thing. You know, because I don't know whether it's because, again, and I go back to being like my age and being a mum.
Maybe it's kind of treated like small talk.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And we're always knackered, like being a mum and all this shit that I've just talked about dealing with. Like, we're always knackered. So we all say to each other, knackered, I'm knackered. But when somebody goes, I didn't sleep very well last night. But then, like you said, it's just small talk. But we don't really go into it. I had to really come out for anyone to take me seriously, lay it down.
Yeah, it's strange that. Anyway, on that note of something we don't have the answer for yet, we will wrap up. But yeah, thank you for listening. DMs, as always, are welcome. We love hearing your feedback on the show. If there's any guests you want us to bring on in the coming months, if there's any Irish guests in particular, send me a DM. Yeah, loads to come. So yeah, thanks, Danielle.
Thank you too. Take care.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.